Well, this morning we're kind of officially starting the book of James. It's a study I kind of started last week and wanted to introduce, and I just want to clarify something, how I introduced it last week. I've called the series Faith in Gear, because James talks about doing good works and doing good things, but I wanted to kind of take it a step further, and not that, you know, we're just these random gears spinning, doing lots of good things, but there's no connectivity to it. And so I kind of came up with the analogy of engaging a gear into like a transmission of a truck or into a vehicle. And when you think of that image, what's really going on there is really quite powerful. Because, you know, if we've got the 100 or so people here going off and doing good things, it's not necessarily maybe what God is calling us to do in this time and space and in this place. I think James is calling us to do more than that. I think he's calling us to band together and engage ourselves into a greater movement. See, when you engage a gear, it's falling in sync with a bigger machine. All the other gears within the transmission, which connected to an engine, and there's a fuel intake here and coolant system, and the wheels start to turn, and all of these things, this complex machine, functions together. It taps into a power beyond the different pieces in themselves. But put together, it accomplishes incredible power, an incredible movement. And I think what James is calling us to do when he wants us to do good works as a result of our faith is not just to do anything, but do something, something informed, something in concert with one another. And so we're supposed to put our faith in gear with what God's doing and tapping into his greater movement. And when we do that, there's this cohesiveness to us as a local church. Now, you're going to be at work and family and stuff and doing all these things. We're not going to be in the same geographical place, but we're contributing to the same kingdom movement. Because together we're discerning what is God doing here and how has God uniquely gifted us as a church and how are we engaging in that. And so the image is just don't go do anything, but let's do something that God has called us to do and is paving the way for us to do. And so in doing that, James is really challenging us and pushing us to Christian maturity, to grow up. Because a lot of times we sit in these chairs year after year and we actually never grow up. And so he's calling us to something else. And part of growing up is engaging and using this awesome gift of the gospel to be used for him. And so one of the first things that James is challenging us to do is to stand in confidence. And so I'm going to spend two sermons per chapter. And in this first chapter, he's kind of challenging us to stand, acknowledge who we are, and to stand firm because of the position that we hold. And so today we're going to look at, you know, facing battles head on. And it's kind of funny, I came across a story of this little bird, Chippy, and how one day the owner wanted to go in and clean his cage, and he had the vacuum going, and the phone rang, and kind of got distracted for a second, and all of a sudden you're just, and gone was Chippy. Just horrified of what she had done, she ran to the vacuum and opened it up and found Chippy still alive, just covered in dirt and dust. And so she ran to the sink and turned on the water and you know, jammed her underneath the tap. And all of a sudden she realized this poor little bird was soaking wet and shivering. So she did what any one of us would do, would go get a hairdryer and try to warm this thing up and blast it. And you know, you can imagine how that went. So when the reporter who was learning of this story went to look at poor little Chippy, he was just sitting there stunned. You know, I mean, who else would really be any different? He was sucked in, washed up, and blown over. And, you know, so many of us, that's how we go through life. We're just thrown into these situations, and we're tossed around and blown around, and we just kind of stand there stunned, and we don't know how to make any sense of it. And as a Christian, and you feel like you're supposed to stand secure, how does this work? Well, James wants to say something about that, but the story he's speaking into to you and me is that so often we live as victims of circumstances when life deals us a lemon. When things don't work out the way it's supposed to, we're a victim. We fall into that mindset and poor me, and we start to blame other people, and we just stand there stunned. We don't know what hit us. And I want to speak to something that is very prevalent in our culture, and it's extremely prevalent around the world, and it's this deception of prosperity gospel. That if you are a Christian, you should not be facing trials. That you should be rich, and you should have no struggles in life at all. And it's a very prominent teaching today, and I want to speak directly against it. That if we truly follow Jesus, it is a path of struggle. It is a path of trials. This whole line of teaching says there should be no trials. You should be, you know, united in every relationship you have. You should have no hard times. And if you do, it's your problem. You're doing something wrong. You're sinning, or, you know, you're being punished for something. And folks, that's just not true. In this life, we will have lots of struggles because the Jesus we follow went through struggles. He was homeless. He was rejected and ultimately, of course, killed. And so we face trials. But are we to live as victims? I don't think so. James speaks into that at the beginning of his book. And what are some of the things that we are to do? And it's really to stand. And to stand is an action. It takes a lot of work to do that. And so one of the things is just a disposition of joy. We're not to be victims of our circumstances. Verse 2, he says, consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds. Now, before I go any farther, I do want to say one thing that when I preach on a topic like this, I actually struggle quite a bit. Because as some of you have invited me into your story and have given me the privilege of walking with you, I'm truly humbled with some of the challenges that you face. And I struggle with the idea of reading a quick little verse and saying, hey, God's in it and you'll be fine. It's not that simple, obviously. I don't want to be so academic about it or even dismissive. Yet there's a power in this verse. And I want you to remember who's writing it and who he's writing to. This is a person who rejected Jesus and eventually came to follow him. And this person was killed for his belief in following Jesus. He was a leader of the church. And he's writing to thousands of people who've been dispersed throughout the Mediterranean out of fear for their faith. Many of them died at the hands of lions or wild bulls or fire because of their faith. And he's challenging them to consider it pure joy to face any kind of trials. And so it's not just a dismissive line, but there's incredible power here. But I do want to acknowledge that I'm going to gloss over quite quickly some of the challenges that I know many of you are facing. Yet if you allow God's word to speak, you'll find something here that really does give you perspective. So he says, consider it pure joy. See, joy is not found for trials. It's not saying, hey, go out and slap the bull and see what happens. You know, you see that in movies sometimes, you know, it's a game, you can slap the bull and see if you can get out. Or go up to somebody and say, hey, your mama looked like a beluga whale. You know, that's creating trials. That's not what this is for. So joy isn't for trials, but joy is found in trials. It's stuff that just comes to us because we're in a broken world. It comes to us when we live out our faith and people just flat out reject it. These things just come, but joy can be found in it. So how does that happen? Well, I'm going to move on. I'm just going to skip a slide here and move on to kind of the main point that he's talking about. The tested faith. So again, we're talking about genuine faith translated into doing something and good works. So tested faith produces full assurance that you've been promised. Many of us have been sitting here year after year hearing assurance and hearing of joy and God cares and all this stuff, and we just ask the question, well, where are you? I'm feeling blown over. But tested faith produces full assurance that you have been promised. He talks about a series of trials. First of all, is trials from without. If you'd like to read with me in verse 3 and 4. So again, he says, consider it unmixed joy, unfeathered joy, my dear brothers, when you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly, but he's talking about trials from without, things that just we can't control, that just happen to us. But he's also saying here that there's an advantage to this. There's an advantage to going through struggles, and it's called endurance or persistence, a courage to continue on. It's an endurance that helps you to stand strong against something. See, trials cause a work in us, and it helps us to go through these paces of being formed, and we can actually develop a staying power. Again, the standing component, staying power in the trials that we face. And he's telling this to a group of people who know this. They've experienced it, and if you have been walking through your Christian life, I mean, we face challenges every day. You're starting to taste and see how perseverance is starting to produce something. So you're getting a taste of it. You're knowing it. And quite frankly, that's why we do this as a church, is we're seeing the story and even some of the challenges that have come, and we're seeing how God has used them and formed them. And we know that they're producing something beyond ourselves. And so he's saying that, hey, you guys know this, that the testing of your faith is producing a perseverance. So there's an advantage to it. And the advantage is a testing process. So trials test us. And what it's really trying to do is test the quality of your faith. All of us have faith in something, but what's the quality of it? And so the imagery here is just similar to the passage that Glenn wrote or read out of 1 Peter. There's an approval of it. It's not say it's proving that it's there, but the approval of its integrity and its entirety. And so it's the imagery of testing gold, putting it to the fire, removing purity so that what remains is something of incredible value. You know, me as a pastor, I do struggle with, what am I going to say on a Sunday morning? How confrontational should I be? Because a lot of times I can do that out of my own discontents, which really says more about me than you. But there are times when, you know what, I need to be challenging, but it's with this in mind that we approve the quality of our faith, because as we go from here and live out any kind of mission that God leads us to do, we will be tested. We will be oppressed and challenged, and the testing of our faith now will help us to endure in the long term. So there's a quality to this, to trials. But really what they're doing is there's this a finishing component. There's a finished product, and it's maturity. There's a growth there. There's a lacking nothing. How many of you feel this morning you don't lack anything? You're just sitting here feeling completely content and assured of everything that God has for you. Anybody dare? There's a finishing product to testing, and it's this maturity, this sense of completion. And it's not like I've got all my bills paid or anything like that necessarily, but there's something that goes on inside that says, I am where I'm supposed to be. I am who I know I'm supposed to be, and I know who's walking with me. I know I'm forgiven, and there's a grace road paved before me, and there's impact that I can have in the lives of other people. It's a joy that you just really can't put into words. And that's where joy comes from. Consider it pure, unmixed, unfeathered joy when you go through these things. Some of you know I'm a hockey player. That's just kind of a great pastime for me. And several years ago, I was on a Bantam team where our coach quit at Christmas. We were tied. We were in ninth place at that point. So, of course, you think the year is a write-off. But then we had a new coach come in, and by the end of the year, we were tied for third. We went on into the city championship, and we won in double overtime. And we went on into cities, and we won cities. Fortunately, soon after, I broke two ribs in a tournament. But anyways, that's a whole other story. But the trials of us as a team helped kind of mature us. We went through a time of being leaderless, being selfish as a team. But then someone came in and rallied us together. He helped us fight through some of those things. He exposed our weaknesses and the quality of us as players and us as a team. And he led us to this maturity of a young group of guys who won all of Alberta. 2 years later, I had the same coach. We even had better players on the team that year. Yet during the season, we only lost two games. And, of course, won cities because it was all the same team. But when we got to provincials and we got to a higher level of hockey, we didn't know how to fight. We didn't know how to go through adversity when it had come. We were so good through the regular season that we hadn't developed that staying power. And we lost in provincials. And so there's something about going through trials. There's something about losing and losing well, failing and failing well, and struggling together as a body. And because you develop a staying power, a persistence, and a maturing that goes on. Of course, a far more significant story is us. And you see that story on the wall. You see a group of people who've gone through various highs and lows and struggles that have now started to test the quality of what we say we believe and the quality of our commitment and the quality of our using resources for anything but ourselves. and on and on. The quality of us as a church. God's been testing us and refining us so that there's a staying power. And because we've come to a place of a little more optimism, we're taking some steps forward and we're seeing some maturity here. But the task isn't done. There's much more yet to come. And the question is, are we ready and willing to go through testing? Are we ready and willing to persevere and to endure, all with the hope of maturity in the end and seeing others come to faith? And seeing this place grow, not for our glory, but for the one that we follow. And if we have all of that in perspective, folks, there's a joy, there's a contentment that's beyond words that I know some of you have tasted before. This is what James is calling us to. He's calling you to do it in your individual life, but then to bring that individual life in concert with others, into gear with others, and us moving forward together as a church. Well, what's our help as we do this? Trials come, they're testing us and persevering and so on, but what's our help and as we do this? Let's look at verses 5 to 11. If any of you lacks wisdom, so again, if we go through this, we lack nothing, but then James says, but if any of you lack wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously without finding fault, and it'll be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That man should not think he will receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. Brothers and sisters, I think it applies to both, in humble circumstances, ought to take pride in his high position. But the one who is rich should take pride of his low position, because he will pass away like a wildflower. For the sun rises in the scorching heat, and with flowers and withers the plant. It blossoms fall and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he goes about his business. So what is he talking about here? What's God really want to give us to work through all of this? Well, he's challenging us to request, to ask, but to do it in a way that is doubtless. How many of you have ever prayed fully believing he's going to answer it? Some of us have. Have we do that often? Well, I don't know. Maybe the other question is, how many of you actually prayed completely believing it's not going to make any difference? I've prayed for healing for people at churches overseas, fully believing in my heart that this can't happen. That's painful to reflect on. I, as a leader, and these broken, wounded people coming up and me praying for them without any sense of belief. God challenges us that we're supposed to request, ask for what we need. And you notice what he's saying ask for? We'll talk about this in a minute, but he's asking for wisdom. Not just knowledge or riches or anything else, but God, how am I supposed to gain perspective on what's going on in my life and what do you want me to do about it? Another component of God's helping is not just asking, but our position as a person. A confessed need. And this is a huge challenge for us in the Western world. How many needs do you have that you cannot meet? Are you going to have lunch today? You know where you're going to sleep tonight? Do you have friends? Do you have a job for tomorrow? Do you have access to health care if an accident happens on the way home? Like, is there anything beyond your kind of sense of control in meeting your needs that you have? Well, God's saying here that, you know, if you're in that position, you better humble yourself pretty quick because it's going to wither away. And it's not riches. It's not a certain bank balance in your bank account or how much stuff you have in your house. It's actually a disposition of your heart. Am I a needy person or not in a healthy way? Can I meet my needs or do I truly depend on God meeting my needs? Is there an evidence of insufficiency in your life? You have a low position because you know you're limited. Or are you arrogant? Because you're sufficient enough to meet your needs. So we need to acknowledge that we can't meet any need truly in and of ourselves. Verse 12, if we do this, blessed is this person who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. Remember in the beginning, it says, blessed is the one who's joyous. Remember the prosperity gospel? You're blessed if you have no problems. Here, it says, you are that blessed person if you persevere. you'll be given the promise of life. And here, life is today, here and now. When you guys go home today, here and now, you can experience a joy-filled life. The last couple of weeks, my wife and I have been interacting with a friend of ours. This girl is kind of funny. I've known her for a long time. Even junior high, I started to get to know her. Almost dated her. Went to camp together, and we explored the idea. Right around that time, she started to go a different way. She started to rebel against her parents, a little bit of challenges in the home with her dad, and she started to go a different way. She got into a very unhealthy relationship with a guy, eventually moved in with him, got pregnant, had a miscarriage, got into drugs, just a really, really difficult life. Several years later, after a lot of challenges, she started coming back. She moved back in with her parents, started getting her life back together, went to university, became a nurse, and moved out to BC to be with her brother and his wife. Her brother is another pastor and was a guy that I have studied with, and me and him have worked through a lot of stuff about ministry together and has become a really good friend. And when I moved out to BC to do my degree, they were there. And so we were able to develop a friendship with this girl again. And Myrna invited her into a prayer group with her and another lady, and they just started to grow together. And we've developed a great friendship. A couple months ago, she emailed us and said that she's been diagnosed with cervical cancer. Went through one bout of chemo and seemed to go well. And then a couple weeks ago, we got another email and say that it's back, it's aggressive, and it's incurable. She's 37. She's got months to live. And so here's, I think about this as a girl who's been part of a little bit of dysfunction, rebellion, but has come back to faith. And out of her broken story, she served some of the homeless people in Abbotsford and was part of a street ministry there and has now moved to Ottawa with her brother and his wife to do a church plant and is just serving incredibly powerfully there. And she's been diagnosed with this cancer, only months to live. And in the last email, she wrote this to us. She said many prayer requests, but eventually said, please pray for complete healing in my body, for a miracle, that God's magnificent glory will be revealed. Finally, please pray that I align my will to the Father's will, that I will be willing to go wherever He leads me. That's maturity. That's Christian maturity. That's in the face of the greatest trial any of us will ever face, finding joy in complete, unfeathered, unmixed joy, because it's not about my glory, it's about the glory of the one that I follow. And in the midst of this trial, I started to see the hand of God working in me. And so I asked people to pray that my will go to wherever the Father leads me. Folks, this is where trials take us, and I struggle to know how to put it into words because it's something you can only taste and see and experience when you go there. God does show up. God does help when you are facing trials from without. James goes on to trials from within. These are ones that we're probably a little more responsible for. And so often we blame God for these things. Let's read verse 13 to 15. So he talks about the trials from without that come to us and how we're supposed to stand. But what happens when these trials come from within? Verse 13, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, gives birth to death. You know, so often we talk about temptation as being okay because Jesus was tempted. But this passage has really informed me on temptation, that temptation actually comes by my own desires. Like it's me fostering and tilling the earth for temptation to take root and where that takes me. And when I get there, I start blaming God. Well, why did you tempt me? Why did you put this person or the situation or these things or whatever it is before me? And James saying, no. God doesn't do that. One, he can't be tempted because evil does not take root in him. But nor will he ever tempt you. He doesn't tempt anyone. Temptation comes when you're tilling the earth of your heart for things to come and take hold. And so God is truly blameless when we start to face these trials from within. So truly, God is blameless, but there's a culpability to our heart, a guiltiness, I guess, to our heart, a culpability that I have created out of my own humanness. I've cultivated these crazy ideas, these corrupted ideas, these desires, these cravings, and because I do that, they literally bait and hook me. So we talk about fishing. The imagery here is putting a baited hook down before somebody and enticing them forward. And we grab it. And of course, when that happens, we fall into the sinful lifestyle and it leads to death. Death is birthed. Trials from within. Need to move on. We have trials from without, trials from within. But in the midst of all this, we have the word from above. We already sang this. Verse 16, don't be deceived. It's not what God's doing. It's the culpability of your heart. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like lifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that is Jesus, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. He's given us something that's in stark contrast to what we often cultivate in our heart, something that leads to death. The word of truth is truly Jesus coming in. He's light, Father of lights. And he wants to birth in you something that whose DNA is consistent with the source of life. And that's Jesus, the person who walked on this earth and paved the way for us to follow. And it's life. It gives birth to life. It gives birth to joy in this life today when you cultivate that in your heart. So what difference could this